Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy. Today's guest is a good friend and legendary trial attorney, Eugene Brown. I like to call him Gene because I consider him a friend. Gene is currently senior counsel with Hinshaw and Culbertson in San Francisco, but he's had a long and storied career. Gene graduated from Cal and then went on to USF Law and got some legal training from the Jesuits here in San Francisco. Gene has tried, as I understand it, in excess of 125 jury trials to verdict, including all sorts of cases, products cases, premises cases, case against railroads, IP litigation in Eastern Texas, toxic tort cases throughout the state and the country. Gene is a member of what I call the Big Four invitation-only trial organizations comprised of the elite trial attorneys in the country. And that's ABOTA, the American Board of Trial Advocates, where he is a diplomat and he's past San Francisco chapter president. He also sits on the national board for our San Francisco chapter, and he has received our chapter's most prized award. That's the Don Bailey Civility and Professionalism Award. He is also a member of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, comprised of the top 500 plaintiff and defense attorneys in the country. He's a member of the American College of Trial Lawyers and, of course, the International Society of Barristers. That's the Big Four. He teaches quite often, trial advocacy, because Gene likes to give back. He's taught at the TIPS Trial Academy that ABOTA puts on, also at the National Trial College. Gene is also a member of the Law Dragon 500 Leading Litigators in America. Gene Brown, welcome to Verdict Academy, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kevin. And you're quite generous with those comments.
Well, they're all true. They're all true. Tell me, how did you and our audience get to know you a little bit before we get into the topics, the top three things you think younger trial attorneys should know? How did you get into trial law?
Well, it was really by accident, Kevin. When I graduated from USF, I set out to find a job here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I interviewed at several firms and I was unsuccessful in landing a position. And I had a friend of mine who suggested that I apply for a job at the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, which I did, and met with then the DA, Lowell Jensen, who ended up being a judge in the U.S. District Court. And Lowell hired me, and I went to work for the DA's office. And I'll tell a short story, which is that I showed up my first day in the office, and it was great. They gave me a bunch of files and said, go through these files and subpoena the witnesses you think you might need if you were trying a case. And I said, oh, that's great. At noon time, the guys came down, and I use that term generically, came down and said, let's go and have lunch. And we went out and had lunch. And at 4:30, everybody said, well, see you tomorrow. And I said, fine. And we left. Next morning, I show up at the office. The elevator doors open. My supervisor standing in front of me with a giant binder. And he says, here, take this and go down to Department 14. And I said, for what? And he said, you got a jury coming in. And I said, excuse me, when does the training start? And he goes, in about 5 minutes. So that's how I got my start.
Wow. That is such a great story. And it's how things were done decades ago. And man, there's nothing more valuable than getting experience on your feet like that. How did you feel? Were you nervous walking into court, ready to try your first case? I mean, days into your career here?
Yeah, was I nervous? I will tell you, I have never been one that likes to stand in front of an audience, right? So I get down there and the jury comes in. And of course, I got to do jury selection. And I'm trying to fumble through this binder looking for questions to ask and this and that and the other thing. And I was so nervous that I sat for the entire jury voir dire. I sat for my opening. I examined witnesses from counsel table. And I finally garnered enough courage to stand up and do a closing. But I'll tell you, I was as nervous as could be.
Wow. What a great story, though. What a great story. And you got through it and you fought through it. And did you get a conviction?
I did get a conviction. And what I will say is that the defense lawyer I mean, I think I saw he just took me from every corner of that courtroom. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, this guy's killing me. But it was a great experience, and I got lucky and won that case. And from there, it was just like, bring them on.
Yeah, exactly. How many years with the DA's office were you, Gene?
I was in the DA's office about 3 years.
Okay.
And there, you could try a case in a week or 3 or 4 days. And so I tried the cases back to back to back to back to back over those 3 years. So I was really fortunate, lucky to have that opportunity.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about the Alameda County DA's office in terms of a training ground. There's been some terrific trial attorneys here in the Bay Area have come through there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that people, I don't know, but Kamala Harris was a deputy in that office long after I had left, but she's someone who is notable.
And then after 3 years, you decided that you were not going to be a career prosecutor, I guess, and then went on to private practice. Is that what happened?
Well, yeah, that was kind of the plan after I discovered what, you know, this law practice is like. So I had a fraternity brother from Cal who was an associate in a law firm, small law firm in Oakland. They had about 12 lawyers. And so he called one day and said, would you like to come over and work with us? And here in Oakland, it's a long time Oakland firm. And I played softball with those guys and went over and talked to them. And they convinced me that that was the thing to do. And so I joined that firm and became the 13th lawyer. And by the time we ended up wrapping that firm up, we had about 80 lawyers. And like I said, I was number 13. And it was all very good. And they were all trial lawyers. And I can say that of the senior lawyers there, 5 were members of ABOTA.
Wow. Ralph Lombardi among them, is it?
Yes, yep. Yes. We had Ray Burgess, Fritz Schwarz, Ralph Lombardi, and others. So it was a very good firm and did a lot of trials. And I was fortunate that I was able to step in there. And because of my experience in the DA's office, I was able to take on a lot of other civil cases. They weren't all large, small cases that the partners would hand down, but I continued to get a lot of experience in terms of trial work.
Fantastic. And is it fair to say you're primarily or exclusively on the defense side, your civil career?
I do exclusively, formally defense work.
Okay.
I have represented, you know, I had a lady who lived across the street from me and she slipped on someone's driveway and broke a hip. And she was, you know, she wanted $5,000 for her medical bills and that kind of thing. And we got her a bit more than that, but that's kind of my experience with plaintiff's work.
Right. And so primarily you overwhelmingly your professional career has been devoted to defending defendants. I know you tend not to do insurance defense work. You're primarily representing self-insured corporate defendants for the most part. Is that fair?
That's correct. Yeah.
Great. And so getting then to the kind of three things that young trial attorneys should know, and that's kind of the focus of Verdict Academy, this podcast. I know one of them that you want to discuss is just kind of going second, the challenge of being a defense lawyer going second in trial. As you know, the plaintiff's got the burden of proof, gets to go first, gets to put his or her case on first, and the defense goes after that. But, you know, first impressions are so important. And once a jury gets certain leanings, I suppose, it can be difficult to get through that. So tell me, what are your tips for young lawyers to how do you get through the defense message when the plaintiff gets to go first?
Well, Kevin, I'm going to back up a little bit and say that dealing with that issue, that is who goes first, really starts when you establish a relationship with the court and the court attaché. And by that, I mean, you must establish credibility with the court. You must be viewed by the court attaché as someone who is vital to the case and someone that they can look to for information about what is going on. And once you establish that, and the court, and when I say the court, I'm talking about the judge, views you as being someone who has credibility and knows what's going on in the courtroom, that attitude carries over at the time that you start jury selection. The jury has to know and understand from the very first time that they come into the courtroom which lawyer is in charge, because one of the lawyers is going to be in charge of that courtroom. And like you say, since plaintiff has the burden of proof and they go first, the first voice that they typically hear will be that of plaintiff's counsel. I like to break that up a little bit and try to have the jury hear the first voice being me, all right? And having the judge interact with me so that, again, we establish a certain relationship, a certain rapport. The jury takes their cue, as you know, from the judge oftentimes. And that's really very important. So if the judge is relating to you as a defense lawyer, going second in a very positive way, and really in a certain sense, and I'm not talking about in the traditional sense of deference, but responding to you in a very positive way, that goes a long way to diffuse that who goes first kind of situation.
Okay. What do you do during the, so the plaintiff gives the opening, you give the defense gives the opening. I'm assuming you always take advantage of that opening at the beginning. You don't wait to defer it, do you?
No.
Yeah. So you got to get your message there. And then a plaintiff puts his case on, or her case. I say use his generically. Plaintiff puts the case on. And then you get to cross-examine. Are you cognizant of making sure the defense themes get out right away in your crosses of the plaintiff witnesses?
Well, Kevin, and I don't know how this happens. I mean, how the magic happens. But I think, if I could just digress for a minute and go back to jury selection, I let when I'm doing a voir dire, I let the jury know that the reason that Mr. Morris is speaking now is because he has the burden of proof and he has to prove his case. I don't have to say a word. I can sit over and say nothing, but I am not going to do that. But that said, bear in mind that when the evidence comes in, it comes in from both of us. He'll ask a question, he'll get an answer. I get to cross-examine. I ask questions, I get answers. So you've got to hear all of that when you're making your decision. So just because I go second doesn't mean that you disregard everything that I have to say or anything that I have to say. You got to listen to both of us. So then in cross-examination, of course, there are some times when we may not cross a witness. If there's got to be a purpose behind everything that you do in that courtroom from the time that you begin talking to the jury until the time that you give your closing. If there is no purpose, and it doesn't have to be a gigantic, monumental kind of situation, but there's got to be something that's at least marginally important before you stand up and question a witness. There have been times when people have called an expert witness and the court will say, Mr. Brown, cross-examination. And I'll stand up and say, Your Honor, I have no questions of this witness, which can be important because the jury goes like, well, why did you do that? Now, you got to tie it up in closing by saying the reason I didn't have any questions is because he didn't say anything important. But that essentially, I think, addresses your question about the issue of going second.
Yeah, for sure. And then in terms of, closing argument, and then you've got plaintiff gets to do a rebuttal after your close. So like, once again, the plaintiff's attorney is both the first voice and then the last voice the jury hears. What do you do, if anything, in your closing to anticipate the plaintiff's rebuttal?
Well, one of the things that I believe that you have to do in trying cases is to always understand the opposition case as well as you, almost as well as you understand your case. And that allows you to anticipate where they're going and what it is that they're going to say. In closing, one of the first things that I do, I dedicate a certain portion of my time. As you know, judges are giving us time limits now on openings and closings and rebuttal and that kind of thing. But I use a certain amount of my time to rebut what I have heard from plaintiff's counsel. And then I do my closing. And then I let the jury know that now Mr. Morrison is going to get up and he's going to tell you, not in these simplistic terms, but he's going to tell you that everything I have just said is wrong. But you've sat here and you've heard the evidence. You've made notes. We've had a court reporter here who can read back the testimony if you think that anything that I have said is incorrect. And you can make a decision. It's your job to make a decision based on that evidence. And so he's got the burden of proof. He gets to go last, recognizing that I don't get another opportunity to stand in front of you and point out the errors in what is being said in this rebuttal.
Got it. We talked a little bit, we touched on jury selection when, we talked about going second as a defense lawyer and what you do in jury selection. Any further thoughts on jury selection or the use of questionnaires? Do you use questionnaires? Do you like questionnaires? Would you rather not use a questionnaire? Does it depend on the case? What's your philosophy on questionnaires?
Yeah, I am not, and I'm not a big proponent of questionnaires. They can be useful in ferreting out some information. But the most important thing about a trial is establishing rapport with the trier of fact, right? And how do you do that? You have to stand in front of the potential jurors and you have to connect with them. You got to be yourself and you've got to let them know that you're a human just like they are and that you understand kind of what their job is and how we all relate. But you've got to establish rapport, and you cannot establish rapport using a questionnaire. Now, the court has its own questionnaire, as you know, which is usually short, a page or two, to get some background information, which I say is fine. And typically, if the plaintiffs or defense come up and they want to use a questionnaire, they'll make them long and drawn out. And if the court is agreeable to using it, the court will say, okay, you've got this questionnaire. I'm going to give each side 10 minutes to follow up or whatever it is. We spent a day with people going through and filling out these questionnaires. You got the information. That makes it tough to establish rapport. The jury doesn't know you from Adam or Eve. So if I had my druthers, I would probably not use the questionnaire. Again, it allows me to stand in front of the jury, allow them to see who I am, to hear who I am, to know me, and to understand that I am there to give them the information they need to make the correct decision on the evidence that the lawyers are going to present.
So jury selection, let's say we've got a 12 or a six pack, so you're talking 18 at a time, let's just say. You get up there, are you behind the podium? Do you have notes? Do you have a chart? Are you just looking at their eyes? Do you have an associate or a colleague who's taking notes? What's your protocol?
Yeah, I take notes during my opposition's voir dire. And because they're going through the process, I try to, as much as I can, I'm not saying that I memorize the names of every juror, but I pick out a few jurors who are notable or potential jurors who are notable, and I pick out a couple questions and answers that have been provided so that when I stand up, I do not use a podium. I don't use a podium for anything at all. And I learned that when I did a program back in New York several years ago. It was a program with some prominent plaintiff's firms back there, and the plaintiff gave an opening or something, and I stood up. The first thing I did was move the podium, and they could record the jurors' reactions to what you were doing. And when I moved that podium, they got an immediate reaction, and when I stood in front of them and talked, it was just going off the chart. So that was a great lesson for me. But again, it allows you to relate, to establish rapport, and get to know the jury. So I typically will have a notepad, and I will try to position it just in case I need to refresh myself about something. But most of my examination of the potential jurors or interrogation of potential jurors is done extemporaneously.
Got it. Just you're in the flow, you heard something that you were listening to their answer, and you heard something that causes you some concern, and so you follow up on that.
No, I do that. And you know what your case is. I mean, every trial involves a case within the case. So, and by that I mean, Kevin, you've got your case, but I also have the case that I am trying to convince the jury of, which is within your case. And I know what that is. And I know where the landmines are. And I know what the evidence is going to be. And I know how the witnesses are going to look. Okay. And you know that just by going through the discovery process. So you can conduct a pretty decent voir dire just having it grown up and put together and strategized and developed your case.
Right. Okay. Before we move on to the third topic, anything else you want to discuss on voir dire? Any tips for young lawyers on voir dire, Gene, that you want to bring out?
Yeah. It's like I said before, and I think I just underscored that you have to be yourself. Don't try to be someone else. I see a lot of folks who want to stand up and be funny or be witty and that kind of thing. I think it's important for the jurors to understand that you're there for a purpose that's serious. Not that you're or can't be a more lighthearted situation, but being in trial is not the place to do that. And there's certainly going to be things that happen where, something's funny and everybody will chuckle, and you've got to chuckle as well. But you're there for serious business, and you want the jury, or I want the jury to know, appreciate, and understand.
Sure. And then lastly, last topic you wanted to emphasize to the younger trial attorneys is the importance of preparation. The three most important parts of getting ready are preparation, preparation, and preparation. So tell me about your work ethic, what you do. You parachute in a lot of cases, I think. And tell me about what your work ethic is and the importance of preparation.
Yeah, it's absolutely essential. The three P's just are really the crux of everything that we're doing. And it's important. One of the reasons that it's extremely important is because I hear a lot of lawyers talk about the hours that they expend in the off hours when they're in court all day and they come back and they're in the evenings working into the late hours and doing this and that. I think that is really suboptimal. And that's because you can't be at your best if you haven't gotten a good night's sleep, you haven't gotten a good meal, and you're not ready to go in the morning. So when you're working your way up to trial, what I would say, I don't know, depending on the case, it can be the last 90, 60, or 30 days, is when you bear down and when you prepare, when you develop your and establish what you're going to do on cross-examination, on direct examination, and jury selection. That's when you prepare. Because when you get to the trial, the case should really, to use an overused term, should be in the can. You should know what's going on. Now, there are always going to be some things that you haven't planned. But if you know your case, and if you have an understanding of what you got in the jury box and who your witnesses are, you can handle those little detours without a lot of trepidation. So I hear lawyers say, oh my gosh, I was up until 2 a.m. doing blah, blah, blah. And I kind of go like, I don't view that as being a plus. That tells me that you didn't do what you needed to do earlier on before this trial started to get ready. And so because of that, it is likely that you have missed something. Okay. So, and again, it's because you've got to be ready. You've got to be on when you walk through those courtroom doors in the morning. And again, if you're up till 2 and you get up at 6, I am willing, I'd lay whatever down in Las Vegas that you're not going to be at your best when you're in front of that jury. And that is the most important thing that should be going on.
Yeah, we're like two peas in a pod if we try to case together. During trial, I'm in bed by no later than 10 o'clock. Now, I will get up at 4 or 4:30 to do some work because I'm an early bird if that's required. But by the time you get to trial, like you said, it's in the can. And where the prep work goes are the 5 weekends before, where you spend every Saturday and Sunday in the office going over depth transcripts and discovery responses and that kind of thing, right? That's where you really grind it out.
That's absolutely correct. You know, I like to play golf, and I'm not going to say that I'm good at it because I'd be lying. But you know, when I'm preparing for trial, the golf days are few and far between because that's the time when you can really drill down on what's going on with your case and really get to know it and develop it. Now, that said, what you're doing is you're going back and looking at the information that has come to the fore that you've developed through the discovery process, through the depositions and the like, and through the motion practice, law and motion practice, so that you know, because you've got to know all of that. So you're right, Kevin, that the time to do that is the weeks and months before the trial actually begins.
Right. Absolutely. We're almost done, but we did talk a little bit offline about wellness and staying fit. And you obviously are an extremely fit guy. You clearly take care of yourself. Talk to the younger lawyers about the importance of wellness, staying fit, exercising, keeping healthy while we deal with this incredibly stressful career.
Yeah, and I think we have to bear in mind that staying fit and being fit is kind of a relative term. I mean, we're not all the same people, and we don't all have the same body types and physical attributes. But probably, you know, I'm going to say 30 years ago, and I'm probably being a little bit short on that, but I determined that if I was going to do trial work, that it was important that I be fit. I mean, because being in trial is a little bit like being a prize fighter, right? You've got to be able to go 15 rounds. And in order to do that, you've got to be in the best shape that you can be. So I have a routine that I have been involved in for, again, more than 30 years. I work out with weights 3 days a week. I walk now. I used to run 3 days a week, and then I'd play golf on Saturday and Sunday when I can. And my diet is, you know, I'm not a zealot about it, but I try to eat healthy. I try to keep my consumption of adult beverages, as they say, in line with my view on that. again, because it's important that you're able to actually go the 15 rounds that are involved in trial. So, and I, this morning, again, before coming down here and sitting down and talking with you, I got up, it's Monday, it's a weight training day. I have a gym down in the basement of my home. I went down and I worked out with weights for 45 minutes to get ready. And tomorrow morning, I'll get up and I'll do my 2.5-3 mile walk. So you just have to do that religiously. And I will say I do that during trial, again, because I'm not staying up until the wee hours of the night trying to get prepared for a witness that I've known about for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. I'm ready when we go to trial. So that routine is established and it really benefits you in terms of the work that you're doing. And I would say not only in trial, but it's important to do it just in your normal everyday practice.
Yeah, 100%. You got to stay fit. And what I've found, and I'm curious if you've observe the same thing. You know, I'll get away and take a break and go for a swim in a trial morning at 5 o'clock, let's say, just to shake out the cobwebs. And boy, the ideas I have while I'm exercising away from the desk about, oh, geez, I should do this. That happens all the time. You?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Once, like you say, you shake off the cobwebs, those endorphins get to, you know, coming up and you just become a different person. I mean, it's essential. And I agree with you 100%. Just getting up and doing that little thing in the morning. You talked before about being in some hotel in some small town somewhere. You know, if they don't have a gym or they don't have a treadmill, I'll just spread out a towel on the floor in my room and do some push-ups, sit-ups, and some other exercises just to get myself going.
Yeah, so important. Well, not surprisingly, the half an hour has flown by. Any parting words, Gene, to our young attorneys about your career or any tips for them before we shut down?
No, I've been fortunate and I've enjoyed the opportunities that I've had and I've tried to make the most of them while at the same time keeping in focus other things. There are other aspects of life that don't have anything to do with trial work or the practice of law that are important and we should all bear that in mind. You know, I take a lot of pride. And my daughter was in choirs and a singer and that kind of thing. And I've never missed a concert of hers. And my son, I coached his first Little League baseball team and went to the lacrosse games and the basketball games. Now, you got to put in the time at some point. And so I do that when they're asleep. And like you, Kevin, I've gotten up at 4:30 in the morning to go for my morning run because I was doing something the evening before that the kids were involved in and I needed to participate in that. And then I can fill in the next day. But you got to live life. And what we do in terms of this work can be so consuming that you lose focus on that. But I think it's important to live life and be a participant.
Gene, great words of wisdom. It's been an honor having you on this podcast. And more importantly to me personally, it's been an honor to get to know you and get to be your friend. So thank you for your service to ABOTA and all the organizations you've been. And thanks for being on today.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I've enjoyed this, again, this great opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.